And we're on. Hi, I'm Walt, and this is the Indie Creator Spotlight. And tonight we are talking to Jamal Igel, a magician of pencil, prose, and all things dangerous. How are you tonight, sir?
I'm well. I'm well. How are you, Walt?
I'm trying to stay out of trouble, but it's really tough in this haircut. the reason that we brought you here is we want to get a little insight into how a very prolific creator goes from Big Two to back to doing own titles and apparently back to Big Two again. So where are you from exactly?
I'm originally from New York City. I'm born and raised, traveled around a little bit, but I'm currently live back in New York. So I'm in Brooklyn.
Oh, nice. Are you familiar with our friend Vito Del Sante?
I am very familiar with Vito. Vito is one of the marketing guys at Action Lab, as well as an Action Lab creator with his own series, Stray.
So all you Action Lab guys are all in New York. You have coffee and you're kind of
Vito actually just moved to Pennsylvania. So, you know, most of the Action Lab is pretty scattered. A lot of what we do is, you know, telecommuting. So when we do get together, it's usually at conventions, you know, gives us a chance to see each other face to face. But we do, you know, have a lot of phone calls, a lot of emails, you know, a lot of stuff being traded back and forth. But that just sort of seems to be the way of business these days.
Oh, absolutely. Everything's going digital.
Yeah.
And when you were coming up in New York, when did you first when did you first start getting the pencil bug? When did you realize that you could sketch?
I was pretty early on, actually. I was about 5 years old, and my grandfather took me to see the first Superman movie with Christopher Reeve at the Ziegfeld Theater. And I knew who Superman was. I used to watch The Adventures of Superman on Channel 11 here in New York. They used to show in the afternoons. They would show that. They would show Batman. They would show, you know, the Bugaloos and Sid and Marty Krofft. That was sort of like the afternoon block. But when he took me to see Superman the movie, I don't know if it's that I fell in love more with Superman or the idea of comics, but they were always sort of all around. And my family was always very encouraging of it. So that was something that just sort of popped up very early on. And I started taking art classes after school. And I was that kid who would finish all of his work and then climb under the desk and start drawing. And I became a distraction for the rest of the class because everybody else wanted to see what I was doing underneath the desk. So... So it was always there, but I didn't realize that
I think we might have lost you. Got a frozen connection. Give it a minute to see if you come back in. Oh
yeah.
You froze for a second. We saw, we heard so the rest of the student class were distracted because they wanted to see what you were doing.
Right. So I didn't really, the idea of doing comics as a living really didn't dawn on me until I was about in high school. I was about 13 or 14. And I went to the High School of Art and Design in Manhattan. And that's where it really sort of blossomed, like the whole, you know. But, you know, I got into comics at a pivotal time, actually. I got into comics in 1986, as a reader. So by the time I got into comics, Turtles was out, Nexus, Badger, Killing Joke, Watchmen, Ronin, Dark Knight Returns, like all that stuff was floating around. So, you know, I'm kind of spoiled in terms as a comics fan. Like I came into the industry at, I think, one of the creative high points, know, in terms of like, you know, where things were going, you know, both visually and content wise.
That's amazing. Cause I mean, that really was a big time, because we even saw it for just a minute leak into popular culture, and then it kind of went away again. But you actually touched on something that was pretty interesting. You said you went to the School of Art and Design in Manhattan. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I know a lot of guys who are very prolific as indie creators, and they struggle with their craft. Mm-hmm. What was it like to be a creative amidst other creatives? Can you talk about that?
Sure. From the standpoint of being creative or as a teenager and going to a school like art and design, there was a lot of competition. You know, everybody tried, a lot of one-upsmanship, you know, and it was sort of nerd cliques. Yeah. It's like you took 300 of the geekiest people on the planet and put them in one school, and then they all started forming their own little like nerd circles, you know. Because you didn't just have visual artists there, you had performing artists, you had film, like wannabe filmmakers, graphic designers, budding architects, a little bit of everything. So, you know, everybody found, they either discovered that, you know, the artist that they wanted to be, or decided that art wasn't for them, and they went on. I have plenty of friends who I graduated from A&D with who went on to become lawyers or doctors, or they went into teaching. You know, I have a friend of mine who became a psychologist, you know. So, but, you know, they're all still very creative people, and they all still had that creative bent.
And do they still practice some of that artistic vision that brought them into that school?
A little bit. They apply it in different ways, you know. Like I said, you know, a lot of them, we have a friend of mine, Keith Miller, who's a comic book writer on the side, but he's a school teacher and an attorney. So yeah.
So he's very rarely bored.
Basically, yeah. Plus he fits in, like, you know, he's got a black belt in Aikido, so he fits that in too.
Sounds like my kind of guy. I just wouldn't get into an argument with him.
Nah, he's a pussycat.
What was your first exposure to comics? Did you get a couple of things off the newsstand or in the grocery line, or was it comic shops?
No, it was definitely like the newsstand. You know, we had, you know, sort of local news, a couple of local newsstands near the train station that would have like comics, and I really didn't know that there were comic shops. Again, until, you know, around 13 or 14, it wasn't something that I knew was a thing. I didn't even go to my first convention until I was 14 years old. And then I wouldn't go to another convention until I started trying to get work in the business, because it just didn't seem like my seat. I wasn't necessarily somebody who liked going to conventions. You know, it just seemed like a lot of noise and clutter and everything. And, you know, considering all the conventions that I do now professionally, you know, you would think that I would have been more into it at the time, but that just wasn't who I was. You know, as a kid, I was much more insular. You know, it was my hobby, and it was sort of like, it was my thing. I wasn't really willing to share it with anybody else just yet.
Gotcha. Were you more of a Marvel guy, DC guy? I mean, I know you were saying that earlier, you came up through that very creative time in comics when you had like some of these creators branching out and doing their own things, like Ronin and all that other stuff. Did one over another draw you in?
No, I was definitely growing up. I was definitely a DC guy. You know, it all started with Superman and sort of branched out from there. Actually, so much so that my best friend as a kid was a kid named Gluster, and he was a major, major Marvel fan. So it was a constant fight: who was better, JLA or the X Men, the Avengers or the Teen Titans? You know, who was cooler, Batman or Wolverine? You know. That was a constant source of our arguments for years and years and years. And then I started getting more into the independent comics when I got into high school, because again, I found my first comic shop, which was Forbidden Planet. And they had everything, stuff that I never even heard of.
Is that where you got your Christopher Reeve Superman figure that I see in the background there?
That's one of a couple of them, actually. No, that was actually that one, the multiverse one was actually a gift from a friend of mine, Chris Irving. But there's a few of them. I got the Hot Toys one like sitting above my computer, and I have another Hot Toys Superman Returns figure up there as well. So
I gotta tell you that room is like Nerdvana.
I'm sure you can probably see the katana over the break front.
Oh, I got mine close by. They're functional though, so I gotta keep them wrapped up.
Yeah, same thing. Yeah, that one's sharpened, and there's a reason why it's up there. So,
guys, do you train in martial arts?
My wife does. I don't. I used to, but I'm more of a runner now these days.
What does your wife do in martial arts?
She took Aikido, actually. So she studied Aikido, and then she hasn't done it in a very long time. But
excellent. I've been in martial arts since I was a kid, so I definitely relate. And speaking of running, it seems to be a passion that you've, judging by some of your pictures that we have online, you've lost a lot of weight.
Yeah, as of today, 104 pounds.
That is amazing. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been about a year. It's actually just over a year since I started. And I run 5 miles a day, 6 days a week.
Wow, that's tight.
Well, yeah, I'm trying to break a 10-minute mile by the end of the year. I don't know if that's going to happen, but that's my goal.
Does that kind of give you a break from sitting at the drafting board and sketching?
It's not really so much a break. It's sort of my morning shot of adrenaline. I wake up at like 5 a.m. and I go running. So, you know, it gives me a chance to clear my head and get centered.
I seem to see a big trend in comic book creators where they wake up very, very early and start their day very early. Is that so you can have enough time in the day to do what you need to do? Or is that trying to get that big shot of work in before everybody wakes up and hits Twitter and Instagram and stuff?
And I think it's a combination. But this has been a big change for me, because I used to be the opposite. I used to stay up till 4 o'clock in the morning and then wake up around 9 or 10. And I would work throughout the day. But you know, I've got a 7-year-old daughter now who, you know, I like to see my family before they take off for the I think I cut out for a second.
Yep, just for a second. You like to see your family before they take off for the day.
I mean, luckily they're both, you know, both my wife's job and, you know, the school are pretty close by. But you know, I like to see them in the morning, and then I feel better. You know, when I wake up earlier, I have more energy during the day. You know,
I think we're cutting out again.
You know, and you know, so I get up around 5. I'm out the door by 6. I'm back by 7:30. You know, because I usually stop to get coffee or whatever. and then a little bit of breakfast, depending if I don't feel like cooking. And then, you know, Corinne goes to work and Katie goes to school, and then I've got, you know, the day to myself until I have to go pick up Katie in the afternoon. And, you know, I managed to get done. I used to, probably.
The speaking of working and getting stuff done, do you go old school pencil, or have you made the jump to digital?
No, I haven't completely made it. I mean, I do color and I do design work digitally, but, you know, as far as comics, I'm still an analog man. You know, old school pencil, brush, pen, you know.
Nice. And you ink all your own stuff, or you got, or do you use digital for that?
Hands on. Okay.
I'm sorry. Ink your own stuff, or do you go digital for that or send it out?
No, I ink my own stuff. I mean, it depends. Some projects I shoot straight from the pencils. Like, I'll just scan the pencils and I'll bump them up a little bit in Photoshop. But I usually, if I am going to do something, I would prefer to ink myself, but sometimes there isn't enough time to do it. And, you know, it also depends on the effect that I'm going for. You know, sometimes a story looks better with a rougher look of pencil as opposed to brush. Yeah. So I'm not as proficient in like dry brush techniques as somebody like Sean Murphy or Mateo Scalero. So my brush inking, or my inking, tends to be a little bit smoother in general. So, you know, it's easier for me to replicate a similar effect in pencil and then manipulate it a little bit in Photoshop.
Nice. Now, I was looking at some of your artwork throughout the week as I was getting ready for this. Mm-hmm. And like you had said, you know, you were definitely a fan of DC. Was that always, as you were coming up, the goal to try and get into the DC house and draw some of those characters that, you know, you grew up loving?
I think it was a goal. It became a goal. But I think for the longest time, I think it was more important to just get in to the business in general. I mean, it just sort of seemed like I ended up at DC, you know, in general. I mean, DC is where I got my first comics related job ever. It's, you know, the place where my work was first published. It's where I got my start, you know, and I ended up working there exclusively for 7 years, you know, and I'm still a DC fan, and, you know, it's hard to break away from those things that you love sometimes. So it just sort of worked out that way. I mean, I've done stuff for Marvel, but it just seemed like every time Marvel offered me something, DC offered me something better.
So. Nice. And, you know, we see a lot of your work coming up through the ranks, but then it seems to really rise to prominence when you get into Supergirl. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. It actually, how I was originally approached to do Supergirl when I was working on a miniseries called Tangent Superman's Reign. And it was the same editor, Matt Idelson, and Nachi Castro, who was an editor at DC at the time. I guess Matt's not at DC anymore either. But I was working on the Tangent miniseries for them. And I was actually at a store signing in Chicago when they called me and asked me if I wanted to do it. And I wasn't sure, because I hadn't read Supergirl in a long time. Like, I picked up the first few issues, but I wasn't really overly thrilled with what they were doing on the book. And when Matt called me and asked me if I wanted to do Supergirl, I was just like, are people going to get upset? Because I don't like leaving jobs in the middle. I was halfway through this miniseries, and I was actually having a good time because I was getting to draw the Justice League, you know, really enjoying it. And I said to Matt, are people going to get upset that I'm just like leaving in the middle of this series? And he just said, what would you rather do, this miniseries or draw Supergirl? And it's like, I'll take Supergirl. But it wasn't something that I was shooting for. It wasn't something that was on my radar as a creator. Because as much as I like Superman and the Superman universe, Supergirl wasn't something that I thought that I was appropriate for. At least, you know, that was my thinking. So when I accepted the job and I asked who was going to be the writer, and they said Sterling Gates, and I was like, Sterling Gates, what is his porn name? I mean, it is his legal name. His legal name is Sterling Gates. That's the name he was born with. But I'd met Sterling very briefly at a con in New York. Read like one of his Green Lantern issues. He did a Green Lantern fill-in issue, and I thought it was okay, you know. But they sent me the script for the first issue, which was Supergirl 34. And I read it, and I was blown away by how good it was. So much so, I'm like, you know, taking it to my wife. Is like, you gotta read this. This is really good. So, and Sterling and I just hit it off, like, automatically. Like, you know, I've been very lucky that I've had really good collaborations with a few people where, you know, you're just in sync. You know, Sterling is one of those people. And it turned into something much more special than I ever imagined it being. Like, you know, I really enjoyed working with Sterling, and I really enjoyed working on Supergirl. And I think there was a lot of things that we had planned that we just couldn't get around to doing, you know, which says a lot because of all the stuff that we had crammed into this run, into a 2-year run. You know, I mean, by the time we got to Supergirl 50, it was just like, I couldn't believe it. You know, and it's funny for me too, because I can sort of track, because I started working on Supergirl right around the time my daughter was born. So for those first 2 years, you know, I felt like I was drawing it for her. So
is that kind of where Molly Danger came from? That
absolutely. Or Molly Danger evolved into that idea. And I've said this before, that it was the combination of, you know, having a daughter and working on Supergirl and having the opportunity to talk to a lot of women who are comics fans about what they were interested in, what they wanted to see, and what they were looking for, and then talking to retailers and talking to families, and, you know, wanting to create the gateway that I had as a young comics reader. For me, you know, Superman, Captain America, and Spider-Man, and all those characters were my gateway into the larger comics world. And I feel like a lot of younger readers get left out of that equation because, you know, the bigger companies don't know how to sell those characters to a wider audience because they're trying to sell the same character, same versions. Not Marvel so much, because they're getting a lot better in terms of synergy. But DC, for example, is trying to sell the kiddie version, you know, on lunchboxes, but sell the now post New 52 version to, you know, men 18 to 49. And it creates a little bit of confusion. You know, it does for me, because, you know, I would like to see a more gestalt version, you know, appeal to readers across the board.
The everybody's looking for that magic equation that makes that one character look good to everybody, I guess.
It's hard. It's very, very hard. I mean, we keep, like, even with characters that have been around for 80, 90, 100 years, you know, or even longer. I mean, people are still trying to find ways to bring back John Carter or to make, you know, Tarzan appeal to a wider audience. They kind of are able to do it with Sherlock Holmes, but there's different iterations of the character and different takes of the character. There isn't a single version that seems to appeal to everyone. But I don't feel like you have to appeal to everyone. I think, you know, that's one of the mistakes that we make, is that we think that a character has to appeal to absolutely everybody. You can't please everybody. And you really shouldn't try. The best thing that you can do is do the best work that you can and hope that it finds an audience.
Oh yeah. And is that kind of, going back to Molly, mm-hmm. is that kind of what led you to start a mixed media campaign? Because you have the like the audio going along with this,
right?
With actors and stuff like that. Can you talk a little bit about that process and
sure.
how Molly came to be?
Well, Molly originally started. I came up with the idea with Molly on a car ride with a buddy of mine. And I had just gotten back to New York. I was working in Los Angeles as a storyboard artist at Sony. And I just returned to New York after about a year and a half, sort of dejected, but trying to rebuild my life, and we were coming back from a convention and we were just sort of tossing around these ideas about, if we were going to pitch a cartoon, what would we do? And the name Molly Danger popped into my head, and it sort of evolved from there. And the first version, I had written a script, I had designed the character, I had every intention of doing it as a comic. We, my buddy Rich, who was involved with this at the time, had an independent comics company at the time. He was going to publish it. And then I started getting busy with work and I had to put it to the side. We hired another artist. He got busy with work. He had to put it to the side. So eventually it just sort of sat and languished for about 7 years or so. But Molly never disappeared. It was just sort of something that I had to put it to the side. Around 2010, I was approached by a publisher looking for all ages superhero material. And I was kept like kind of banging my head against the wall. I was like, what can I do? What can I do? Oh, wait, what about Molly Danger? So I took a look at what I had written before, and it was very complicated. It was sort of this like Alice in Wonderland through the looking glass sort of thing, where you didn't know if, which version of Molly was the real version, if she was, just a normal girl having this fantasy life, Walter Mitty style, or she was like jumping back and forth between dimensions. Is way, way too complicated. So I rewrote the entire premise of the character. I started from a single idea, which was she's Molly Danger, and she has always been Molly Danger, and that's all she knows about herself. So building from that, I wrote a new pitch. I designed new characters. The only character that didn't get a redesign was Molly herself, because I just thought that it worked. I didn't, I did a couple of sketches of like a more, I guess, Brian Hitch inspired Ultimates version, but I was just like, no, that's not who she is as a character. So, she's a kid. She dresses like a kid. She dresses like a kid would dress, if they were a superhero. Yeah. So I pitched it, never heard back. I took it to Tor. I took it to Random House. I took it to a lit agent. Nobody knew what to do with it. So I put it on the shelf again. But I was still working at DC at the time. I was still on contract at DC. So my big plan was I would start writing the book while I was still on contract. And then once my contract ended, I would start working on, I would start doing the artwork. So, you know, we flash forward to mid-2011. And I decide that I don't want any, I'm done at DC. I don't want to draw any more DC characters, you know, not full time, not on contract. I wanted to do some other things and have some other opportunities. Cause you know, 7 years is a long time to be at any, in any job. And I found myself sitting at my desk just saying, okay, now what are you going to do? What are you going to do to yourself? Are you going to just freelance? Are you going to, you know, come, you know, work on one of these big ideas that you're always thinking about? And I was approached by another friend of mine who wanted to work on a project with me and pitch it to this, try to get the funding through this website called Kickstarter, which I'd never heard of at that point. So I looked at the Kickstarter website and I said, I don't need to team up with anybody else. I can do this myself. I can build this. I can try and do this campaign. And again, it's like, what could I do? What could I possibly pitch to Kickstarter? And then Molly was just sort of in the back of, you know, somewhere in the back of the room going, pick me. So
kind of like a 10-year-old would do, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that was it. I just decided, you know what? I'm going to do Molly Danger. I'm finally going to get around. I'm finally going to do it. And I talked to a few people and actually had a few people try to talk me out of doing it because they didn't think it was commercial enough to do. But I decided I wasn't really concerned with the commercial viability of it. I just, you know, I've got this story in my head that I need to tell. And so that's where we are. You know, I pitched it. We, you know, the first campaign was very successful. Now I'm, you know, trying to raise the money to do book two. And with the audiobook actually came afterwards. The audiobook, we did the audiobook about a year later. I was approached by Lance Axe and Elaine Lee from the Audio Comic Company, and they loved Molly Danger. They were very interested in doing an audiobook, and I agreed to do it. You know, we recorded it in a day.
Wow, that's really fast.
Yeah, we did the bulk of the recording in a day. We had like 9 actors working out of a recording studio in Maine, and we had a great time. It was a long, long recording day. We got it done, and it came out really, really well. I was very happy with the first book, with the first audio book. So when I decided I wanted to finally, because I had delayed book two by about a year because I was still fulfilling Kickstarters from book one, and I wanted to at least get the bulk of them done and out to people before I even thought about, you know, doing book two. So, but part of the idea of doing the audiobook and the graphic album at the same time is so that they would both be available at the same time for, you know, because, you know, a lot of, you know, people who are vision impaired picked up the audiobook. There's a lot of families. I talked to families who got the audiobook and they play it for their kids in the car, you know, when on road trips. You know, it's full cast audio with sound effects and music and, you know, totally encompassing that theater of mind aspect. And then there's the one slightly selfish strategic reason, which is the young lady who played Molly in the first audiobook, Olivia Duford, was 11 when she recorded the first book. It's now 2 years later. She's 13. So I don't want to have to recast the part. And she still sounds young enough to pull it off. You know, I didn't want to have to wait another year and then have, you know, a Peter Brady moment happen where she's suddenly like, you know, three octaves lower and we have to get another actress to play Molly. So.
Now, is she cool with it? Or is she like, no, I'm 13 now. I can't do 10.
No, no, she's good with it as far as I know. I haven't heard anything otherwise.
Oh my goodness. Now with the rest of the cast, are these all like trained voice actors
These are all trained voice actors. Bill Dufresne, who is the voice of Austin Briggs, is the original Bob the Builder.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So we have like professional. Robin Miles is a very popular, she does a lot of like voiceover work and she's been on like Law and Order and a bunch of different shows, you know. And, you know, so we have like professional theater and television actors working on the show.
Now, was it different for them? Because a lot of times these voice actors, you got, you know, you're working from a video presentation and you can kind of gauge, what the emotion you need for the voice from that video. But your art is very alive, especially in the first Molly. And, you know, with what we've seen in Supergirl, your art is very, very crisp, very alive. And did that help them make that transition?
I think it did a little bit, but also, you know, you're talking about people who have, you know, Molly wasn't their first production. They've done audio comics has a large library of productions that they've done. So these are people that they've worked with on a regular basis, or people who are in, you know, the either animation or do audiobooks on a regular basis, you know, stuff like that. So, you know, if they were having a problem with it at all, it didn't show, but it definitely helped to have that visual aspect for them to play off of and sort of shaped the characters.
Now, did you get to help at all with like sound effects, or did they have like a sound engineer?
They had a sound engineer. I actually ended up doing a couple of voices. there's the scene where Austin first goes to the Molly Dome and he meets Emmett Bastian. I actually did a voiceover as sort of the welcome to the Molly Dome. You know,
that's actually pretty good.
So a few bit parts. You know, I'm hoping that my part gets expanded next time, but you know, you never know. You never know with these things.
I've just got this weird fantasy that I just want to sit in a professional recording studio one day with like plastic wrap to make the sound for fire or something like that.
just a lot of old school Foley, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're on Kickstarter now. You have what, 9 days left?
Yes, 9 days. It ends on the 17th.
9 days left, and we're about a little less than halfway there.
Yeah, it's been rough. It seems like the atmosphere for Kickstarter has changed. There are a lot more projects on Kickstarter now. A lot more, I don't want to say mainstream creators, but better known creators doing comics projects on Kickstarter. So it's been a little bit, you know, of a time trying to drum up interest from people. But it's not, it hasn't deterred me. You know, Molly, these books are going to happen, you know, regardless. You know, I will find a way to get them done, you know. And even if this campaign fails, you know, I am going to try again and keep trying, you know, and keep pushing. And, you know, this is the work that I never expected to be from me to be as passionate about as I am. So know, it's really important for me that I make this happen somehow.
Well, one of the things that we're seeing, especially in comics, is that more multi-age or you know, products that can be for the whole family, and not just in a way where you say whole family and it's cartoonish, but whole family as in there's a little something for everyone. We've seen this with things like Molly Danger, Atomic Robo, stuff like that.
Right.
And I think there's a big market, and people do want to see more stuff that you can sit down and either read by yourself, or you know, if you got that 7-year-old hanging around the house and they jump in your lap and, hey, Dad, what are you reading? You know, I think that's that not only is it an admirable thing to chase those types of projects, but it's also something that I think we need more of, and that it's really great that you're doing this kind of stuff.
Thanks. No, I absolutely agree. I think it's like I was saying before, you know, I feel like we need that gateway project, and it doesn't really matter like what media it is. You need something that appeals to the largest possible audience. You can't please everybody, but you know, my approach is similar to, you know, the way Pixar approaches their films, which is, or old school Warner Brothers, where you don't dumb it down, you know, just because kids are involved. One of the biggest pieces of advice that I got before I started writing the script for Molly was from a children's book editor who said to me, don't be afraid of serious. Don't be afraid of dark, you know, when it comes to kids, because kids are a lot, and I see it in my own daughter, you know, kids are a lot more together than a lot of adults have a tendency to give them credit for. I think as adults, we forget what it's like to be a child and have that sort of mindset. So we just assume that because they're children that you have to simplify things for them, and you don't. Kids understand. If you find a way to explain certain key concepts to them, kids do understand these things. So, you know, my approach to writing Molly is, you know, not to dumb it down or pander. You know, it's write a good story. Write a good, compelling character. Worry about the nuances later about it either being, you know, Molly's a girl, but I don't dwell on the fact that she's a girl. You know, I wrote Molly in a way that it could be either gender. You know, it's just about telling a good story, developing good characters, making them believable, making them characters that you care about, you know, that you want to see succeed. If it's a villain, you want to see the villain fail. You want to see the hero be triumphant. I think, you know, there was a Comics Alliance article that's been going around today where they were saying that, you know, people are tired of seeing the quote unquote strong female character because it seems to be as much a cliche nowadays as the damsel in distress. And I tend to disagree that that's just something that applies to women. I think that there are a lot of male characters who get slapped with the idea of being a strong character, but being a strong character without any nuance. So, and one of the most difficult things that you can do as a writer is create a character with some level of complexity. You know, even if you're trying to tell a very straightforward tale, you know, I think that people mistake trauma for complexity a lot of times. You can build a backstory for a character without that backstory being traumatic necessarily, but you could still make them a complex character but still basically good. And I mean, that's what I tried to do. you know, I'm trying to build a character who is complex but a basically good kid.
And we're seeing that too with Molly, because if you look at the story and the story that you're building, not only do you have, you know, the superheroine that everybody looks up to, and she goes and punches robots and stuff, and that's the draw of the story. But as you get into it, there's a big element of this story that's about loneliness.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's about, ultimately the story is really about finding yourself. It's a coming of age story. It just happens to be about a, you know, an immortal 10-year-old superhero.
Did any of your personal experiences inform Molly's narrative and how she reacts to certain things? Or were you writing for somebody else?
No. I think that the lead characters in Molly, you know, not just Molly herself, Molly, Lauren Holder, Commander Holder, Austin, Brian, are all representative of parts of myself. You know, Austin is the 20-year-old me who suffered from arrested development before he became a father. Brian is the lonely kid that I was, you know, growing up, you know, without a father. You know, Molly represents a few things. You know, but Molly is more. There's a lot of me in Molly, but there's also, Molly is my way of sort of exploring a lot of the subjects I'm interested in. You know, I'm interested in, you know, the psychology of celebrity, you know, the you know, having been, you know, having had a kind of a sheltered childhood in a lot of ways. You know, I didn't, you know, my father left very early, and it was something that he died recently, and even up until his death, it wasn't something that I'd ever really felt like I reconciled. I tried on several occasions, but it definitely affected me very, very deeply. And, you know, Lauren Holder represents the father that I've become. You know, the disciplinarian, you know, who doesn't want to be a disciplinarian, you know, but is sort of forced into that role because you have to be.
Absolutely, especially when you're dealing with a child that you take responsibility for.
Absolutely. You know, and it's harder for her because it's a, you know, in book two, we kind of delve into her relationship with Molly, which goes back, you know, 20 years. So you have in Lauren someone who was once Molly's pilot, who aged and grew and changed, looking at this little girl who hasn't changed and hasn't really grown and doesn't have the same capacity to mature that, you know, somebody else her age or, you know, coming up would be. So she, you know, you go from being the big sister to the parent, and how do you adjust that? Yeah.
Sounds really, really like you got several intense things, but the great thing about this is it's still, like you were saying earlier, this is still something that a child can relate to.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know,
I hope so. I mean, that's definitely my intention anyway.
Oh, I can definitely relate to it because, when I was younger, you know, my mom had to work and stuff like that. And we had, my little sister is, over a decade younger than I am. And, you know, you go from that role at one day, you're just, you know, big brother playing. And then all of a sudden, you know, now I'm preparing dinner or I'm doing this or I'm doing right. that. So yeah, you know that. So you see a story like Molly Danger and you're like, oh, I remember what that's like. That's, yeah. That's pretty groovy.
Latchkey kids of the world unite.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And do we have the same cast back for the audio presentation?
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. The entire cast is back for book two.
And you had said earlier that, you know, even though she had aged a couple of years, she's still back on board for Molly.
Yeah, Olivia is back on board, and Bill is back as Austin, and Robin is back as Lauren Holder, and Lance is back as Medulla.
So when we see volume three, do you think you're going to have to recast, or is it your daughter that's going to get the role?
Oh, I don't think Katie's really interested in acting just yet. We'll see. We'll see. You never know. Hopefully it won't take that long, but hopefully there won't be a 3-year gap between books two and three.
Now, your daughter, when she enters your studio there and looks around, does she say, like, Dad, draw me a Supergirl?
No, her thing's not Supergirl right now. She's sort of splitting her time between My Little Pony and Mega Man. So yeah, and then we did Free Comic Book Day. She got a bunch of books, and I promised her I'd get her a full copy of Cleopatra in Space, and a couple of other things. So yeah, she's a budding comics fan. She is, but she doesn't really ask me to draw her or anything. Like, but she'll draw things for me, which is sweet.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
With Molly coming out with volume two, and then do we have any other projects that are starting to peek from under the desk and so you can show your classmates? You had mentioned earlier before we started, you got a Wonder Woman project hitting.
Yeah, I did an issue of Sensation Comics. The print issue will be out in June, but the first chapter is on Comixology. It's a 30-page Wonder Woman story that I did with Josh Elder. I don't know why I blanked on his name for a second. No, Josh Elder wrote a great 30-page story. It's old school Wonder Woman, old school Perez era Ares. It's a lot of fun. It was good. It was me and Juan Castro, who also inked me on Molly Danger, is inking me on this story. And like I said, chapter one just came out on Comixology, so that's available. And then the book will be in print in June. And then also in June, Action Lab is reprinting the miniseries that Jay Ferber and I did at Image back in the early 2000s. Venture will be coming out. The first issue will be coming out in June, and that'll be shipping bi-monthly. And then I'm working on a couple of other things, a couple of other Molly-related things that'll get announced, later on in the year. But I've got my part-time job, which is as vice president of marketing for Action Lab as well. So that keeps me busy when I'm not drawing or writing or doing half a dozen other things, going to conventions.
I was going to say, I was going to push a little bit of my ancient nerd cred and try and acquire the rights for She again from Billy Tucci.
Oh, Billy is never going to let that character go, believe me. I think he's still trying to find a way to like do another She story. Yeah. I think that's Billy's goal, and that's his. You know what? That's his book. I would never even deign to try and do it because it's unless it was something that he wanted me to do, But that's his thing. I have some other projects that I would love to get to that I'm developing. We'll see what happens. But I need to get Molly done first. Before I feel comfortable, tackling any other like creator-owned projects.
Nice. Now, with regards to Molly, how much of volume two do you already have done?
Working on the script and designs. I haven't had a chance to really do any artwork yet, just because it's very time consuming. A page of Molly ends up taking somewhere between 2 and 2.5 days to pencil.
Oh wow.
Yeah, there's a lot. I'm doing, you know, it's a European style album, so there's a lot more detail, and the pages are actually physically bigger than standard American comic book pages. So it takes a bit of work to do.
How big are the European pages?
13 by 17.
And
that's a live area.
So yeah. Because traditional American is what, 11 by 17?
Well, when I say 13 by 17, I mean that the area, the actual panel size is 13 by 17. The actual pages are 14 by 18.
Oh my God, they're huge.
Yeah, they're pretty big. So, and then, because the live area on a standard American comic is usually like 9 by 14, 9 by 10 by 15. So, yeah.
Wow. Yeah, yeah. You got a lot of surface area to sketch on.
There's a lot to do. There's a lot to do. And I tend to be a fairly tight and complete penciler. So, you know, if I'm going to make somebody ink it, I'm going to put in the work first.
Absolutely. Now, if you had the chance to talk to somebody who wanted to do what you do and wanted to kind of put themselves out there and start doing something like this, what would be a good place to start?
In terms of education or just in general?
Just in general, what's good?
Well, I mean, things are a lot different nowadays than they used to be. I mean, there's so many more outlets for, you know, particularly an independent creator. You could do it in print. You know, you can do short print. There are companies that can print comics, short print runs. You could do it online. You can, you know, post it on Tumblr, start a web comic, collect the pages, and do a print comic later on. You know, you've got crowdfunding sources like, you know, Kickstarter, Indiegogo, Rocket Hub, you know, all these different Patreon, you know, all these different avenues that you can go. So, you know, my advice used to be, you know, be patient, but that only really counts, honestly, if you're, you know, trying to break into the big two. Well, not even like the big two, the big five or six now. If you're trying to break into a larger company, you know, there is a lot of patience that's involved. There's a lot of honing of skills because for the most part, especially, you know, your Marvel, your DC, you know, Dark Horse, IDW, Boom, they're looking for very particular styles and a certain level of professionalism. But if you just want to do comics, just do comics. You've got so many more opportunities to get your work seen. You know, for myself, like, it took me 8 years before I was consistently making a living doing comics full time. Like, I had a lot of years where I know how to stretch a box of macaroni and cheese and an 8-pack of Nathan's hot dogs over the course of a week. I learned that skill very early on. So, you know, I know what it's like to be a young creator trying to break in and try, you know, making that hustle and, you know, living on a little bit of money and just trying to get stuff done. But if you're dedicated to it, you could do it. You know, you just have to really just, it's about the work more than anything else, you know. So there's that. As far as other pieces of advice, be professional. Act like a professional. Treat your work professionally. Treat your peers professionally. Don't be a dick. Seriously, because it's a small business and all you really have is your work and your reputation. And sometimes it doesn't even matter how good your work is. If you've got a reputation for being difficult, people aren't going to want to work with you. You know, that's true in most businesses. So yeah, don't be a dick.
What's that? Will Wheaton's number one rule, I think.
Pretty much, yeah.
That's awesome. Well, You've been very gracious with your time, and I don't want to keep you too long because you have a family that I'm sure is looking to get some of your time as well. If people want to stalk you on the internet, you know, in a nice way. Yeah. Where can they find you on the web?
You can find me, just look up Jamal Igel. I'm on Twitter, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Google, I'm on LinkedIn. I'm very friendly, very approachable, but don't be a dick.
Right on, right on. And we got Molly Danger Volume 2 on Kickstarter right now. So everybody just go out, you know, click the links, do, you know, we're going to put those links in the show notes. And we're going to do what we can to boost the signal far and wide, make sure this thing gets funded.
All right. Thanks a lot, Walt.
Hey, and I'm Walt. This is the Indie Creator Spotlight, and we are out.